Hello, welcome to the second and last episode of this series from the Max Planck Institute for Biogeochemistry in Jena. I am Andres and will be hosting today's episode. This week we will continue our conversation with Professor Susan Tromber, who is the director of the Biogeochemical Processes Department in this MPI. In this second part, we will talk about the link between fossil fuels, economy and lifestyle, as well as on the role of scientists in our society, climate activism, and some other topics. I wish you enjoy it. In that sense, there have been some recent theories or debates about economic degrowth. Mm-hmm. So economic degrowth poses that we have to change the paradigm in which the economy has to keep growing steadily so that we can reach a better quality of life. Mm-hmm. And it seems that this is taking us to the wrong place, to bringing humanity to a very fragile balance between the social, economical, and environmental systems. What do you think about this way to see it, that we need to stop growing economically? Mm-hmm. Because because it's quite related to the CO2 emissions. Sure. Economic degrowth is hand in hand going on with fossil fuels, let's say.
Well, it's economic growth, population growth, and fossil fuel growth. I would say that economics and the fossil fuels are more linked, but they're also linked to population. Mm. And I think, since the 1940s, 50s, or, since we've had the ability to really burn fossil fuels, you can also see that population, when I was born, there were 3 billion people. Now there are 8 billion people on the planet. And of course, someone like me who, there's just that many more people who need to buy food and, have water and a place to live. And so there's been this massive need to produce things for people because you couldn't just, take the table from my grandfather's house because there's 7 grandchildren and they don't all need a table, right? So there's been this need to build things that's driven so much of this growth economy, because the population was growing, the energy demands were growing, all these things, so the fossil fuels were growing. Part of the population increase is fueled by the fact that we use that energy to fix nitrogen, and so that fueled the green revolution for agriculture. And we just passed the 100th anniversary of the Haber-Bosch process, and what's interesting is they published a paper, and something like maybe half to two-thirds of the people who are alive today were born because there was enough food for them, So, but we are starting to level off, so the demographic shift happens because basically death rates fell a lot because of better... fossil fuels did a lot of good things for us. They gave us, drugs and things that let us live longer. So people are living longer. And if the birth rate's the same, that leads to an explosion in population if death rates declined. And now we're at the point where, birth rates have started to decline globally, especially in places like Europe, but over most of the earth, wherever women get educated, birth rates decline. So we, we're leveling off that population growth. So when I was a kid, people were talking about 15 billion people. And, now I think the idea is that things will level off somewhere between 9 and 10 billion people. So not that much more growth. Mm-hmm. So we have to learn to live with less growth, because now you'll see people urging people to have children, but I don't think that's the answer. So it's not just population, it's what fraction of that population overuses, fossil fuels, because not all people are contributing equally to emitting CO2. It's a very small fraction of the population that actually is making the climate problem. But, and so, yeah, I mean, I think growth has to go down, but we also have to think about what kind of society we'll have when it's not a growing population. And so I think humanity has a lot to think about. It's not just economics, I think it's also society. So I grew up, you know, in a place where birth rates were much higher than death rates. So my generation has not experienced death as much as probably future generations or generations before, just because of we happen to be born in this in this transition. And that means culturally very different things, I think, for us than for people before and after. What that means for economics, I think it's very clear that we don't have to have societies that are based on buying things. I think we already have enough things, and especially when, you know, I think, you know, in a country like Japan that's had a declining population for a while, you see they have more houses than people to live in them. So, so you know, you don't need construction anymore, but maybe you make the place you live more beautiful, and so, or you garden more, or you, you know, do something else besides acquire new things, you know, and I think that's what we have to learn how to do, but it'll be interesting to see if we can do it.
Yeah, it's indeed a change, not only in the socioeconomic system itself, but it's in how what we perceive as valuable for us, what we need to.
Yeah, and it's a lot to change in one generation too. So it's your generation's got a lot to do.
A lot of responsibility. Yeah, and well, talking about responsibility, there's currently a debate that has taken a lot of relevance, and for the ones who are not informed, so annually in the United States takes place one of the biggest meetings for Earth and planetary scientists, and last December it took place. This is called the AGU meeting, and in this meeting, two scientists unfurled poster or flyer, in which they were. So the flyer was literally saying, out of the lab and into the streets, as an invitation for the scientists to take more action in their role as scientists. Maybe trying to say that we have done very much about publishing and writing papers, but maybe we are needing to trespass those boundaries and take more. Trying to have more incidence in the public policy, and so these two scientists were their presentations in the Congress were withdrawn, and one of them lost her job due to these actions. What do you think about us as scientists? What should be our role in the society other than scientists? Yeah. If it does.
Well, I think we have to play two roles. As scientists, we have to present what we know as facts. And that, you know, there are a lot of things that go into political decisions, and climate change is one of them, but it's not the only one. And 'cause societies are complex systems too. But I think, I mean, for Rose and I forgot his name. I know one of these people because she works on soil carbon. I mean, it's unfortunate that they chose to do what they did the way they did it, because they had, you know, they broke a rule that they had signed a conduct thing, and the consequences were written in there that that code of conduct was created to prevent harassment, but it also was to prevent people disrupting things. So whatever. I think the story is not finished yet on what their punishment is going to be. There's a lot of people weighing in. A lot of people, including me, feel that the AG went too far in what they did because they removed their abstracts after they had already given their talks. I mean, Rose losing her job is an example of your public and your private role as a scientist. So she works for a national laboratory. Mm-hmm. And part of the point of working for a government institution is that you're supposed to be neutral in your job. And because she was traveling to this meeting representing her institution, they said, this is your job. I don't know the full story there, but I worked at a national laboratory too. And so I know that you have to be careful. You're still free to say, you know, now I take off my hat as the Max Planck director, and now I'm going to tell you what I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine too. We're all free to do that too, because we're human beings as well as scientists, and we of course have political opinions, and we should be able to express those freely, but not, you know, with my name tag on that says I'm the Max Planck director. I think we do both. So I know, you know, like in the Science for Future marches, we can go and talk about what we know, right? We can go and say, here are the facts for climate change. And we can do that at a protest. But if we then join the protest, I think then we move beyond the factual thing. So we can do both. It's really sad because I was remembering in 2019, there was a climate march during the AGU meeting. And a lot of people, they advertised it, a lot of people went out and joined the march. And, you know, it was the right way to do that kind of thing, I think, is not. Because a lot of us are active politically as well as scientifically on these topics. So, and the AGU itself has, I was part of writing their climate change statement, which basically says the time for talking is over and the time for action is here.
Yeah.
And it went a little bit further than we thought people would want to go, but in fact, it's there. And, you know, that also, it was strictly scientific in terms of saying, here's what science says the impacts are going to be, and they're going to be disruptive to human societies, human health, and, you know, other things and ecosystems, and they're going to be expensive. and so they are going to be so expensive that maybe it's cheaper to go alternative energy. And I don't know, it got distributed to Congress and in the U.S., which, you know, doesn't mean a whole lot. But, you know, finally there's some significant action on climate change there. So I think we're being heard, but it's everything's moving so fast, and people are not fast. People don't like change. So it's very hard to grasp things. But I'm actually positive. I think it's been slow, but I'm surprised that there's anything at all.
Yeah, what I have heard from some opinions about this topic is that, okay, yeah, we have big responsibility as scientists by providing information so that decisions can be made with the facts on the table, but at the same time it seems that it's not working pretty good because the transition is happening maybe too slow for what society requires, and. Yeah, some scientists are more concerned than others and decide to to bring their action farther.
Yeah.
And should we, as you said, we are human beings, part of a political system or a society that is highly politicized in all what happens. So if some of them some of those scientists decide to bring their actions further, why should they be punished? So that's what I have heard about the people who...
But I don't think they were being... They were just being punished because the way they did it was against the rules of the place where they did it. And they had signed something saying, I understand this code of behavior and I will abide by it. That's why they were punished by the AGU. And the AGU, if you read their code of conduct for meetings, it's there. You know, if you disrupt a meeting, you know, if you disrupt a session, you will be removed from the AGU. And so it's not like, you know, because they had just developed this code of conduct, it's only the last couple of meetings that we've had it. And it really was there to prevent harassment, but also disruptions. And I think it's the first, it's not the first test. There have been a number of incidents at these meetings that have been dealt with behind the scenes. This one obviously was very public. And I think there's an ethics committee that's listening to all sides. They're taking in all the comments into account, and they had 90 days to kind of decide what to do. But they also realize that whatever they decide and whatever they say is going to shape the future, right? So I think they're going to take their time and think carefully about this. But I also know the person whose session was disrupted, and she said, look, you know, we wanted to, the session they did this in was one, it was a big plenary on art and science and how to communicate things like climate change better through art to the community. So probably everybody, I mean, it's very hard in AGU to find someone who doesn't agree that climate change is a problem. And there probably it's, you know, a lot of people there take part in some kind of political action. So I kind of was like, why are you standing on here, you know? but anyway, it's almost like, you know, preaching to the wrong people. But Mika, she said, you know, I wanted people to get something out of our session, and all anybody talks about is this incident. They don't talk about what our session was about. And so she's an activist. She just said, I'm really frustrated because had we talked about this beforehand, you know, we could have come up with something that maybe got the same message out, but without you getting to get thrown out of the meeting because it was part of the presentation that was planned. You know, so it was more, I think, just really poorly thought out on their point. I know that had they gone to the AGU and said, look, we want to have a town hall on how to get more active politically, I think AGU would have probably given them time and space for it. So it's also choosing who's the bad guy, you know, that you're protesting against. It was kind of a weird, for me, it was a weird place to decide to have a protest because everybody agrees with you already. But I do understand the frustration that things aren't happening fast enough. And I think it's really important to keep that pressure. So it is important to have people out there protesting and being extreme. But if you want to be trusted, if you want people to listen to your science and you feel like you have something scientifically to say on the subject, then I think you have to make a choice then. Am I going to be like way out there, you know, gluing myself to paintings, or am I going to be someone that people feel they can trust, you know? And I'm not sure you can do like really extreme things at the same time as trying to get people to listen to your science.
Do you think that scientists will lose credibility if they take action, like extreme action in activism?
Well, I think the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, you know, is one of the reasons people turn the corner on their thinking about climate change, because it's scientists from all over the world, it's a consensus, the governments have to read it and comment on it. It's a little bit conservative, maybe, but no one can point at it and say it's wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's self-correcting, so there are occasions when something goes wrong and all the climate deniers jump in and say it's wrong and it's fixed in the next version. Mm-hmm. But I feel like had we not had all the scientists of the world in unison saying, you have to pay attention to this, we would still be arguing about whether climate change was real. But the arguments were so strong, and that was, but it was client, it was neutral advice. We weren't telling people what to do about it, because that's not actually for scientists to say. It's for governments to say, because the facts are one thing. What you do with them is politics. And you do have to think about what's good for one group might not be good for everybody. And so it's easy to point and say, you know, the oil companies are all evil, and but we're all living with the benefits of the fossil fuel economy, because many of us wouldn't be alive without it. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to accept that, you know, maybe we needed fossil fuels to get us to the point where we had the technologies to build solar cells. I don't know that we could have done it or made the batteries that we need to, you know, without having this. So I think it's an interesting point, but I do think that as a scientist, I know my corner very well.
Yeah.
And for me to go beyond that and say, I can give advice as to what I think are the good ideas, and that's where I take off my, you know, my hat, where I say I know this to be true, and then I can go and talk to politicians and give advice. But it's going beyond. I also have to recognize that politicians have to think about more than climate change, and unfortunately, too many of them think about getting reelected. but they also have to deal with, people need to be fed. You know, we have to, you know, people are demanding cheap gas and oil, you know, and so all of those things have to come together. I think it's up to people, you know, and so protest is good to force action, but I think the actions are not easy, and so that's why they're not getting done. So pressure is important. But my carbon footprint is large, and I bet yours is too.
Yeah,
So we have to think about that when we tell other people that, you know, they're evil.
Science has a lot to say, but there are other alternatives too. And for example, lastly, when we speak about the values of the society in terms of what we want, and this permanent thirst to grow economically, to get, to buy, to consume, are in contradiction with, for example, some other visions or understanding of the world, like indigenous communities, mm-hmm. In which the spiritual world, the feelings, the thoughts, the relation with nature and with other beings of nature are more essential than the relationship with, materialistic elements. So how can we get closer, get the scientific perspective that seems to be quite rationalist to the understanding of the indigenous communities, for example, in the Amazon forest, who think that the rationalism is not as important as the spiritual world or the relation with nature?
Well, that's not... I can't talk scientifically about that at all, because I don't know enough about those things. I think we've, as a global humanity, we've painted ourselves into a corner, because without fertilizers that are produced by fossil fuels, I'm not sure we can make enough food for everybody who's on the planet right now. So that's one of the problems that we've created for ourselves is, you know, we and the livestock that we carry with us have really exploded our populations, and part of that is because of fertilizer. So if we stop all that, population has to decline. But I agree. I think we need to think about more quality of life. So that's all just saying I'm not sure we can all live indigenous lives anymore without agriculture, but because simply there are too many people. But maybe I'm wrong, and somebody can correct me. I'd like to be wrong on that. I think science can learn a lot from indigenous peoples, because, you know, when I go to the Amazon, clearly I know nothing about the ecosystem that I'm walking in, and we always hire local guides and people who know a lot more about every species of tree than we will ever know. And so, and what they can be used for, you know, these kind of things, a lot about their life history and things like this. So I think we lose, I think a lot of what's wrong with people's psychology is a loss of connection to the natural world. You know, when I was teaching in Southern California, you know, people thought that there were people in my classes who had never been outside of LA in this kind of artificial concrete ecosystems, constructed ecosystems. I mean, you could argue that Germany also is mostly constructed ecosystems, and that people really, but at least here, people have a love of forests and their use. So I don't really have an answer to that. I just think that humans need to rethink their value systems in ways that can deal with a lack of population growth, but also acquiring less. The idea is that material wealth is not necessarily spiritual health, and I would agree with all of that. That's just me personally. I have sufficient personal wealth that I eat enough. Yeah. I have enough to eat. So.
Yeah, I also agree that there's... so science has to pay more attention to other alternatives to understand the world. Not only science, but the society has to reformulate the way how it's relating to other beings or parts of the of nature. Yeah, and in that sense there are other ways, like the indigenous communities have posed something interesting happened in Bolivia and Ecuador. So they, in their constitutions that were in the last decade reformed, they posed the rights of nature. So nature has their own rights to, in which humans have to defend it, but...
But no, I think it's an advance. I don't want to live in a world without tigers, but we're close.
Well, we are coming to an end, I would like to ask you about, so you have had a long scientific career, and you have reached a position that might be the goal for many of the early career scientists. So you are a world authority in topics like carbon cycle, climate change, radiocarbon. And you also were managing director of the Institute for some years. What are the pros and cons of having such a big responsibility?
Well, for me, the big con is that I don't get to do much myself anymore. I'm mostly mentoring people who do the work. So my big joy was always to go to the field. Mm. So now a few weeks a year, I can go to the field and with my students and be their field assistant. That's my that's my big fun. I've had the administrative part has made me give up on a lot of that. I think for me, the big pro. So when I started, I was often the only woman in the room. I was often, you know, especially going on ships in the 1980s when I was doing it, there weren't other women on the ships, and I knew that however I behaved would frame how the women who came after me would be treated. So I think, I hope that for women now it's a little bit easier, that they can have a little more flexibility in what they do and how they behave, because there are more of them, and so that's been good. But I think a lot of my career has just been convincing men that women can do science. I hate to say it.
Well, but somebody had to do it the first time, and it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And other than science, what are you interested in? Which topics fill you with passion?
Well, I'm afraid most of my hobbies are science as well. So I'm an editor of a journal.
Mm-hmm.
And I really actually enjoy writing and editing, and that's not just from the science side, but I enjoy that a lot. But it's a lot of my free time seems to go there, which is maybe too much. I like to be outside, hiking, exploring, doing those things, and I like to cook.
What's your specialty?
Chemists are always good cooks. I don't know, what's my specialty? These days it's lentil soup, because it's cold outside.
Always tasty lentil soup. Yeah.
So, yeah, and I travel a lot. This is why my carbon footprint is big, but I have, you know, because I've had so many students and friends, I have friends all over the world. That I like to visit when I can. So.
Keeping the network alive.
Keeping the network alive, yes, it's important.
What do you think you would have studied if geology wouldn't have been an option?
So when I was really young, I wanted to be a zookeeper. I really wanted to work with animals, and then I wanted to be a veterinarian in a zoo. But I ended up working on rocks and soils. I think the other thing I really wanted to do was I wanted to make movies. I wanted to communicate through media to talk to say how important science was. But or I wanted to be a writer. I think those were the two things I would have done.
Well, somehow you reach it. You write a lot of papers and...
Yeah, I think I was more thinking novels.
Yeah, finally, Sue, if you would like to communicate these topics in a light way to the public opinion, like to explain about climate change and carbon cycle, what would you recommend them to read? Any source that you can...
So actually, that's what I was looking for beforehand. My former PhD advisor, Wally Brooker, he died a couple of years ago. And he wrote a lot of books where he tried to give his view of the carbon cycle. So he wrote one that was called An Executive's Guide to the Carbon Cycle, I think. I can't remember the name of it, but if... His website, you can download all of his books as PDFs. So he's got one that's called, I have to look it up. Well, he wrote one that's called How to Build a Habitable Planet. That's sort of just generally about the Earth and why, and global biogeochemistry. But the other one was CO2, the Earth's Climate Driver. So
those are
the ones I would recommend. He also wrote something called A Life in CO2, My Life in CO2, which is published. It's kind of his self biography with all the things he did to learn about the carbon cycle. And so he weaves it very nicely together. So it's kind of a personal story plus a personal story in science plus all the things that he discovered, which is really cool.
Okay, well, so we talk about many different topics. We talk about climate change, tipping points, about your career as a scientist and other alternative ways to understand environmental problems. I want to thank you very much for being with us, and I wish you the best with your projects.
Thanks, it was a fun conversation.
Thank you very much.
That was today's conversation. Thank you all very much for listening. It was indeed a very challenging first time as a host, but definitely a very pleasant and interesting experience. If you want to know more about the work of Professor Trumbur, you can find a lot of resources in the website of the MPI for Biogeochemistry, which I will leave for you in the show's notes, along with her recommended books. Thank you very much for listening. Keep calm until the next episode and stay happy. Bye.
Opsri Magazine, the podcast, is brought to you by the Max Planck PhDNet and the Science Communication Working Group, known as the Opsri Magazine. The intro-outro music is composed by Sirina Rankumar, and the pre-intro jingle is composed by Gustavo Carrizo. For any feedback, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to write us at opsri.podcast@phdnet.mpg.de. Until next week, stay happy. Bye-bye.